Talk with Pastor. First of all, this is Sunday school. I debated giving you all a test. I did that one time years ago before I actually went to the mission field. But, you know, you can do it yourself. Can you draw that diagram and fill in the blanks, what the squares mean, what the arrows mean, and give a Bible reference to it? That would be your test. How well do you know prophecy? Since I'm not doing prophecy, I'm going to do something else that I talk with Pastor about. We're going to do this book, evidently, Avoiding Confusion. In today's world, how do you avoid just coming apart? And one is, what's your cornerstone of living? What do you go to? And in the midst of all the things that are happening, I think this will be good. Why do people become killers? This is a news article on a school shooting. Why does some guy decide to get a gun and kill as many children as he can and teachers? I don't know if you've read much news, but with the latest school shooting, somebody said, where was God? And I guess what? You guys wanted God out of the school, so why would you even ask the question? God was there. He knew what was going to happen. Number two, we say good guys with guns are the only ones that will stop evil guys with guns. And they said, what happened? Well, the good guys with guns did stop the evil guy with a gun. Imagine if the shooter knew, that there was no security and there would be no police coming. He barricaded himself in a room, and yes, there were children still in there that he shot, but they exchanged gunfire through a door in the beginning. So he knew that the police were out there with weapons. But imagine if there were no police and no weapons. So after he kills everybody in the room, he walks outside and gets all of the parents who came down to try to rescue their children. There's no stop to it. And one of the things politicians or whoever has got to have to deal with is, I don't care what kind of laws you pass, evil wickedness is going to happen because Satan is alive and real, and there are people who will do these things no matter what their situation. In fact, several of the school shooters do not appear anywhere on anybody's radar. They just suddenly have done something that everybody's kind of shocked with. I want to read this to you. Why do people become killers? There are only three reasons, and I thought, sounds like a good thing. By the way, this was a school shooting in May the 27th in 2018 in Texas. Following the most recent school mass shootings, this time in Santa Fe, Texas, where 10 students and teachers were killed and 10 were wounded Friday, family members, friends, and investigators find themselves searching for elusive answers. By the way, not too big in the news. Not only did he kill, 21 people, he wounded 17. That was a lot of that, too. Why did this happen? How do you make sense of such a senseless tragedy? Your organization is unique, but there's one thing all facilities share: the fines you can get if you're not in compliance with local, regional, and national regulations. Texas Governor Greg Abbott pointed out that unlike recent mass shootings, there were not these types of warning signs. The red flag warnings were either non-existent or very imperceptible. The accused shooter's parents said the media reports of the shooting seemed incompatible with the boy they love. The 17-year-old boy's best friend said he was one of the most responsible people I knew. He didn't drink, he didn't do drugs. To my knowledge, he was academically proactive, making straight A's, 2018. Given the profile of this, emerging investigators have yet not identified the motive for the shooting. And this guy that wrote this says, however, I know precisely why this latest killer did what he did. I also know what will motivate the next killer to act in a similar way. Many years ago, I became an investigative high-profile murders in Los Angeles County. I carefully chronicled the motive of every homicide that occurred in our region. You might think there are a million reasons why someone would commit murder, but there are only three possibilities. At least one of these three motives is the driving force behind each homicide, theft, burglary, and robbery. In fact, these three motives lie at the heart of every conceivable crime or misdeed. Human misbehavior is motivated by financial greed, sexual lust or relational lust, and the pursuit of power. Three ways, to which I add lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So guess what? There will be other shootings. And somebody posted up that, did you know, if you took how many people have been shot and killed versus how many have been killed because somebody got stabbed, somebody got strangled with hands, the guns didn't kill as many people as people did with their bare hands or using a weapon in their hand. You might be wondering if this is a fourth category. There isn't. What about jealousy? What about anger? Ask yourself the question, what is causing the jealousy or anger? There are only three answers to this question, and now you know them. The notorious gang MS-13 inadvertently confirmed these three motives when leaders chose the model for their criminal organizations: kill, steal, rape, control. All murders, kill, are motivated by financial greed, steal, sexual lust, rape, or the pursuit of power, control. Sometimes only one of these motives is the driving force behind the crime. Sometimes two or more are involved. And the latest school shooting is a good example. While there doesn't appear to be any financial motive, the killer does appear to have been driven by the other two motivations I've described. In the news, his mother of the latest school shooting said he was bullied at school, but they've interviewed students who said he was the bully, that he sought out to bully other people. He was known for doing that. And then he gives more about this particular shooting in Texas. But the three motives for shooting in schools still exist, still there. I don't care what gun control laws you pass. I don't care how restrictive you get. That's still going to happen because you can still get guns. And I was reading recently, people I've been watching on a YouTube blog as they go through the world, leaving South Africa, they're now, well, they actually, where we eat lunch once a week sometimes in the Caribbean, where the Pirates of the Caribbean was filmed, is only a mile and a half from our house. They anchored out, and a guy anchored with them to kind of be their own security guards with each other. He got robbed, they didn't, in the night, and somebody had what was called a pipe gun. And in case you're not familiar with that, you know, you can make an unregistered gun in America. You can order parts, no serial numbers, nobody can trace it, and you can put a gun together, and it'll work. Whatever you want, AR-15, a handgun, that's possible. A pipe gun.
You can't order all the parts online.
What? Oh, okay.
There is a limit. They will ship most, but not all.
No. Okay. But if you use different sources.
It will be registered.
But this guy that was robbed said he woke up with somebody with his hands on his throat, and the other guy was carrying a pipe gun. You can make a gun out of pipe. When I was a kid, they made them out of antennas off of cars. So if you want to make a gun, you can make a gun. May not be the best in the world, but it will kill people. And as long as there are evil, wicked people around, they'll find a way to do that. So this will be the book. You'll have a couple weeks to decide if you want it. I don't know what the church is doing, but they're going to get you all a copy. And we're going to talk about how to avoid conflicts, problems in today's world. Now, today, I talked with Pastor, and I've talked with some other people, and they liked some of the things that I've had to say about cults. And so how to deal with a cult. Got to turn this thing on. There we go. JWs, Jehovah's Witnesses. Y'all had one knock on your door? Everybody? The newest thing is they send you a personal letter inviting you to study with them. But I've had them knock on our door, not only in America, but also on the islands, both islands. So we've had contact with them. So I don't know how well this was going to show up. if you can read that, Studies in the Scriptures, Series 3, called Thy Kingdom Come. 1908 is the copyright date on the book. This particular book we found in a closet that probably was untouched for 40 some odd years. And I put it aside, and one day I just happened to start reading through it. I don't know how much you know about Jehovah's Witnesses or cults. One thing about a cult, no matter who they are, they always have who is wrong. They have a different Jesus than the Bible. That's one of the things that will define them as a cult. The other one would be how to get to heaven, and they have a different way to get there. All right. Now, again, I don't know how much you can really tell, but on the left side is a diagram of a pyramid. Now, just so you know, after you start reading through the book, you need to know the diagram of the Great Pyramid, because that would help you understand your Bible better. Now, we're talking Jehovah's Witnesses in 1908. Okay? Now, in today's world, if you talk to Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't like the fact that this book is available. After I got that one out and read it, I ordered one on eBay for $2. So you can go looking for it if you really want one. And it's got printed on it by the Watchtower and Tract Society. It's right on it. So they can't say that's not ours. It is theirs. But if you ever talk to Jehovah's Witness, they would, well, they have said that Christ was going to come 1913 or 1914. And they said that was spiritual. That was not a physical prophecy, because the test of a prophet is to be, what, 100% correct. And if they prophesied Jesus was going to come in 1913, set up his millennial kingdom, then they're wrong. They don't want to admit that they're wrong. So this was a spiritual thing. But here's a book. Again, see the diagram? Where it ends at the bottom is 1913. And it says millennial kingdom at the very bottom. So in other words, we're living supposedly in the millennial kingdom that Christ set up. And the fact is, that's not spiritual, that's much physical. And in fact, there's another diagram of the same thing, basically. And if you read the book, you'll have different places where I've underlined. What many call Christendom will have passed away as already shown from prophecy by 1914. In other words, only the Jehovah's Witnesses would be still on this earth. You and me and every other religion but them would be gone by 1913. That's what this book is teaching in 1908. What am I getting at? They're false witnesses. And when you confront them with a book like that, it's awful hard for them to say, well, we're the only ones correct. No, you're absolutely wrong, because you fail the test of a good prophet. You fail totally. And I have some more. And it's in the same book. Whether you get the book or not is irrelevant, perhaps. But if ever you talk to them, you can say you know, because you've seen at least a book printed in 1908 by the Watchtower and Tract Society. Jesus Christ was going to come and set up a whole new kingdom in which all the other religions were going to disappear. It was physical, was not literal. I mean, it was physical, not spiritual. Not only that, they talk about in there a resurrection of the saints in 1914. So where are the saints today? They still say sleeping in the ground, but your own book says they were resurrected in 1914, or would have been, according to their prophecy. Now, again, I do not know how much you have worked with, talked to a Jehovah's Witness. I have brought with me a different Bible. I don't know, excuse me for doing that, Pastor, sorry about that. But I brought a Watchtower and Tract Society Bible. Whenever you talk to a JW, Do not let them use this. They want to. By the way, they are the only ones who use this. Everybody else has rejected it for good reasons. But they, by the way, consider this one compares very well, they say, to the NIV. Well, at that point, I put a big question mark on the NIV. Okay? So, again, this is what they'll try to use when they talk to you. Don't let them do it. They will use a King James Bible. Make them use a King James Bible. Romans 6:13, if you would. Look it up. Sorry, wrong verse. 10, chapter 10. Romans 10:13. Somebody want to read? Okay, that's what it says in the King James. What do you do when you translate a Bible? You try to take this word and put it into whatever language you're translating it into. You all familiar with where the King James was translated from? Koine Greek. Okay, Textus Receptus. All right. The word Jehovah. Now, when I first read about Allah, I thought that's Arabic or something for God's name. No, that's not so. I'm Alan Berry here. Do you know what I'm called in the Marshall Islands where they speak? Marshallese, Waikin Yana, Jakwe Lal, Erle Tak, Juanwat Nejin, Waywat Jabberwat Eya, Jako Amor Indreo. When I speak like that, what do they call me? Alan Berry.
Pastor Ben.
Or Pastor Berry, maybe. And what happens when you take one name to another language is generally you keep the name many, many times. Their translation says, instead of who shall call the name of the Lord, L-O-R-D, they use the word Jehovah. So the question then becomes, where did they get that word from? This is supposedly a translation. Now, when the King James Bible was translated, we had about 5,000 manuscripts, 5,000 parts of a Bible. Maybe when I say a manuscript, I don't mean they had 5,000 complete New Testaments. Some of them didn't have complete books. They had sections of books or paragraphs out of a book. We had 5,000 like that, okay? Since, 1611, we now have 25,000 manuscripts. The Dead Sea Scrolls, 1949. And I remember reading some of the critics were saying, we're going to prove the Bible is in error. And they found a book of Isaiah. They found that it's one of the oldest things, period, that they've ever found. They know that because of the parchment that it's on. They know that because the ink that was used and the style and so on. They also know it because in the Hebrew, they did not use any vowels until Babylonian captivity. They're afraid they would lose their language in captivity. So that's when they added vowels to the Hebrew language. So with the Dead Sea Scrolls, they had the book of Isaiah, no vowels. And it was dated way back. And so we're going to prove it's wrong. The Masoretic text is what we call the Old Testament text from which we did the Old Testament, and Jews still use the Masoretic text in their synagogues today. So here's the book of Isaiah. They unrolled this thing, and it took them well over a year to do it. And the last thing I read on it said, word perfect. No changes. It's exactly as the Masoretic text gave it. So we have 25,000 texts. The question is, which one of those texts have the word Jehovah in it? There are two issues that are in today's translations. One is majority rules, and the other one is oldest is best. Okay, we go with majority rules. You got 100 versions of a particular section, let's say, and they say the same thing. And then you have an older manuscript, you think, and it says something slightly different. Which do you go with? If you're majority rules, you'll stay with 99. If you say oldest is best, you go with the older one. Now, the guys who did the older is best found their manuscripts in a place where the garbage was found. They had a limit to that. Now, that's an interesting scenario because according to tradition, according to anything I've ever read, people who copied the Bible were very, very careful in what they did. They were human Xerox machines, if you would. They did it in columns, as they, you know, unrolled it in a manuscript. They would count all of the words in a column, forward and then backward, till they knew how many. They would do their copy and count the words. If there was a mismatch, how do you find the error? And what are you going to do? Well, they were perfectionists that did this kind of thing, ADHD or whatever, and they actually would throw the old manuscript away and start over. Imagine being in chapter 66 of the book of Isaiah and make a mistake. You threw it away and started all over again. Now, as soon as you hear that, you say oldest is best, and these people are finding their manuscripts in the garbage pile. You ought to be questioning, was that a good copy that they did? Because it's in the garbage pile probably for a reason. So at any rate, those are the two main things. So in Romans, despite it saying 6:10-13, for everyone that calls on the name of Jehovah will be saved. That's the New World Translation. Where did the word Jehovah come from out of 25,000 manuscripts? Oh, I've seen the book. We have some differences in our manuscripts over the years, seriously. And so just real quick, don't turn me off. Listen to this very carefully. They've categorized them. They put them in a book. They know what they have these all numbered or named or whatever, each one of these manuscripts. And the differences between that they've found oldest is best even versus majority rules is only 1%. It's only 1%. I've seen a book that makes that kind of a comparison. And out of the 1%, you have to realize they counted it if the word order was different. Instead of blessing and praising God, it was praising and blessing God. They would count that as an error, 1%. They also had spelling errors. Well, they didn't have dictionaries back then, and that was kind of a freelance thing, but that's considered part of the 1%. No major doctrines have changed. Nothing else has changed. So when I say there's 25,000 manuscripts, in the letter to the editor, this guy who wanted to push the New World Translation, I wrote, I challenge you to tell me where did the word Jehovah come from, which manuscript. I'll give you $500 if you can tell me. You should be able to look it up and tell me. Still waiting. Still waiting. In fact, some months later, he wrote again. I wrote him back in a letter to the editor. I said, I'm still waiting. I challenged you before, and you still haven't done it. Verse 16, it says what? Come on, not in my face. Verse 16 says what? 10:16. Somebody please read.
For if the first word, Jehovah, the law is also
No, 10, chapter 10. Yeah.
But David have not, but they have not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah said, the Lord who hath believed, the Lord who hath believed our report.
There it is again. They have in the New World Translation the word Jehovah. Now, why am I keep bringing this up? Because they, if they talk to you, want to use the New World Translation, and you're going to be able to tell them, no, because you people have modified the Bible to make it fit what you want. Now, verse 9, chapter 10, verse 9. What does it say?
That if thou shalt confess with thy mouth the Lord Jesus, and shalt believe in thy heart that God hath raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved.
If they translated that one with the word Jehovah, they would have to say Jesus is Jehovah. And they didn't do it. But 240, 50 times, I forget the exact number, they put the word Jehovah in when it fit their theology without a single manuscript. And so now they're wanting to talk to you and use a New World Translation and say, no, 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 it's not even close to being right. I have got a lot of other places where I know that they have changed what we have to something else. Okay. John 1:1. As I said, a cult, Jehovah's Witness, Mormons, Seventh Day, whatever cult it is. We have a cult down there called Spiritual Baptist in St. Vincent. They're neither spiritual nor Baptist, but they have that name. But a cult always gets it wrong about who is Jesus Christ. Now, John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was,
and the Word was with God,
and the Word was God. It's a good translation. Jehovah's Witnesses completely do it different. Now, some of you, because of your age and if you've had contact, I remember being told by a Jehovah's Witness, Jesus was a glorified man. I don't know if you've heard that before, but that's what they considered him to be, a glorified man. Well, that really doesn't fit all that Jesus did. So then they said, he's a great angel. And that seemed to work a little bit better. But,
Brother Barry,
yes?
I had a Jehovah's Witness when I was in school. This is years ago before I met you. And he says, I got the King James Bible. I said, yeah, you got it, but you don't read it.
No. That's true.
They use their own.
And so I remember sitting in a home in St. Vincent when this Mormon told, not Mormon, J.W. told me, Jesus is a God. Now they have a translation thing. We have some things, you know, like in English, we have certain rules of grammar when you go from present tense to past tense to whatever, or you have tense and verb agreements. And they have a Greek thing to translate that verse, a God. And I still remember hearing a pastor say that he had bought a home, he was in a cul-de-sac, and he was mowing his yard, and he saw the two JWs coming down carrying a briefcase with the umbrellas. I mean, they identify themselves pretty easily, and he knew who they were. So he stopped, went inside, got his Greek New Testament, got his Bible, and came back out and greeted them when they came up to him and said, I'm so glad to meet you guys. I've been studying the Bible. Maybe you can help me. John chapter 1, verse 18. Somebody read.
No man hath seen God at any time. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared.
No man has seen God at any time. Now, is that a God or is that the God? That's the God. Okay? Now remember, they got a God in verse 1. He said, okay, what about verse 12? Somebody read.
But as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name.
To become the sons of God. Is that a God or the God? That's the God. He said, what about verse 6?
There was a man sent from God whose name was John.
Sent from God. Is that a God or the God? That's the God. See what he's done? And he said, what about verse 1? Is that a God or the God? And see, they want to say it's a God, but he gave them three times in the same chapter where they did not follow their own translation rule that they talk about. And the lady said, I bet you're a Trinitarian. He said, that's interesting you would bring that word up. You know that word's not found in the Bible. And when we use the word Trinitarian, that's exactly what they'll say to you. That's not a biblical word. And he said, that's amazing. You'd say that. It's not found in the Bible. She said, I think this discussion is done. And they turned and walked away. Because he, okay, Trinitarian. Why do we use the word Trinity? Do you know? What? Okay. How do you describe God found in the Bible? A couple of Wednesday nights ago, I went through a lot of verses that there is only one God. In the book of Isaiah, over and over and over again, one God. And there's New Testament references to one God. In the book of James, it says, thou believest there is one God. If there was ever time to correct it, that would have been it. And it says, thou doest well. We should believe that there's one God. But then what do you do when you see God the Father, God the Son, God the Holy Spirit? So the people back, 300 years AD or so, said, we're going to make that a Trinity. That's not three equal, it's not personalities, that's three people who make up the Godhead. And yes, they coined the phrase, but they defined it because there seemed to be no other English. Triunity doesn't fit. I and my Father are one. Well, they could be one in purpose, but the way Jesus said it, they understood. He claimed to be God. So again, when they go to John 1:1 and they say Jesus is a God, they're saying something that is wrong, both because of translations, but also it's not fitting the rest of the Bible. If you're a Hindu, how many gods are there? Do you realize in today's world, there are only three religions that talk about one God? Muslims, Jews, Christians. And by the way, Allah, the name of the Muslim God, doesn't exist. He's a made-up character. And if you do any reading in a Quran, you would find that out. Like even in the Quran, I just happened to say, wait a minute, many, I lost track of the times. Many times they would say that Allah, we gave da-da-da-da to so-and-so. And I'm like, we? No. If Allah is singular, I gave. So even in the Quran, they've got that problem. So that only still leaves Christians and Jews with one God. So if you're going to have Jesus is a God, is a Jehovah's Witness like Hindu? There's many gods. He's just another God. Because that's exactly what's going to happen here if you really think about it. Jesus is just a God. He is not the God. Many gods. Jesus is a God. And they no longer believe in only one God. And that's just in chapter 1 of John. Micah 5:2. But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from what? Everlasting. Jesus came into this world, but he's always existed. That's exactly what that's saying. By the way, the New World Translation doesn't say that, because that would admit that Jesus wasn't created. They think that God the Father, well, not the Father, the God, Jehovah, created Jesus, and then Jesus created the world. This verse says he's always been. That's exactly who he is. And by the way, how important is this? Remember when the wise men came? Where is he that's born king of the Jews? They said, well, that's where he's going to be born, Bethlehem. They knew the scriptures. This was telling them before he was born, that's where he is going to be born. So that's a good verse to use with defining who is Jesus Christ. Yes, he came and he was born here on this earth, but he's always been from everlasting. Now, I don't know if you ever tried to really wrap your mind around that, from everlasting. How do you talk about everlasting in the past? Before there was any solar system, before there were any planets, before there was any suns or stars, everlasting, okay, but then what? We're stuck in a time zone of some kind. Okay, is that any more questions? Because I'm going to try to confine myself to two sessions. I'm going to go to the Mormons. Any questions? How else to deal with a Jehovah's Witness? But you deal with them about who Jesus is, and you use a King James Bible doing it. Okay, Mormons. And again, I've had them knock on my door in America and in the Marshall Islands and St. Vincent both. In fact, in America, it was interesting because there was a time in my life I got out of the Coast Guard and ran a bicycle shop. And the Mormons would come to my bicycle shop to buy a bicycle. So I would encounter them that way. And it was interesting listening to a Mormon talk about the cults of the Jehovah's Witness and what verses they use. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting. In fact, when I read some of the JW stuff, I use those verses against the Mormons. And when I read Mormon stuff, I use those verses against the JWs because they're opposites. Because the Mormons believe as man is, God was. As God is, man shall become. And you can become a God. You will get to build your own universe, become the savior to it, and so on. I don't know. I've got a lot to go through. I'm trying to, do I really want to go all that direction? One time in St. Vincent, they set up a display right in front of the post office. I was waiting for my wife across the street, and I decided I could see when she comes anyway. I'm going to go over there and take a look at their display. And they had pictures of Joseph Smith receiving the tablets of gold. And I said, that's the strongest guy in the world. He's stronger than Samson. They said, huh? I said, well, look at that. Here's Angel Moroni. That's moron with an I on the end of it. Handling these tablets to Joseph Smith. He's got his arms outstretched. And I said, those tablets would be well over 400 pounds. And he's holding it out in front of him. He's not lifting it like weightlifting. He's got to be strong to do that. And they said, oh, okay. And I said, where's the Meadow Mountain Massacre? They said, what are you talking about? I said, you don't know your own history. He said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, you should have pictures of the Meadow Mountain Massacre because that is part of your history of your church. There was a wagon train who was going through Utah, and they were attacked, quote, by Indians. They were attacked by Mormons dressed like Indians. And so when they got into the battle, they kind of defended themselves, but they were outnumbered. And so the Mormons showed up and said, we can get you out of here safely if you give us your weapons. They gave up their weapons, and as they went out, the Mormons, which were the Indians and also the others, killed over 110 people. The most people killed in any terrorist act in America until 9/11. And this, by the way, is history, because when they wanted to become part of the United States of America, they were told, you'll either turn over. They knew the name of the guy who led that massacre. You will give him to us for justice and judgment, or you will not become a state. And they did. They turned him over. They went to court. They found him guilty. And I believe they hung him or shot him. I forget which. But he died because he was the leader of the Meadow Mount Massacre, and he was a Mormon. after he did the Metal Mountain Massacre, they moved him up in the organization. They honored him as Mormon, and that's their history. So that's there. Now, I'm going to give you some things, and I'm going to give you some references that'll help you. Gerald and Sandra Tanner used to be Mormons. She's related to Brigham Young somehow. They pulled out, and they wrote many books on Mormons. They have a website. I think I've got it here later. One of the Book of Mormon is Supernet. Okay. One of the books that they wrote, they say the Book of Mormon is supernaturally translated. Joseph Smith had a stone, a seer stone it was called, put in his hat, put his face in there, and he would tell them how to translate those golden tablets into the Book of Mormon. Super translation stuff. So when a Mormon came to my house and he decided he wanted to shoot Baptist preacher between the eyes, I said, let me ask you a question. I said, do you have a copy of the 1830 Book of Mormon? He's like, no. I said, why not? You're a Mormon. I've got a copy. How come you don't have one? I said, wait a minute. So I went inside and I brought it out, and he got to unwrap it from the plastic wrap, a Book of Mormon. And I said, there you are, an 1830 Book of Mormon. And then I had Gerald and Sandra Tanner's book of the 4,000 changes since 1830 on the Book of Mormon. Some of it is spelling, that's true. But some of it is names, some of it is dates and history, because they realize they can't leave it like it was. It was terrible. I actually believe the Book of Mormon was stolen from another guy who wrote fiction. But that's how the Book of Mormon is today. But there is a book that Gerald and Sandra Tanner, I paid for mine because I like the copy I could take to the door and say, right here, and we started looking, and between what this guy had in his hand and what I had, 1830, to confirm what Sandra Tanner had written, that's what it was in 1830. Now, you've got a new version that doesn't say that, and he didn't have an answer to that. You can get it, you can buy it, and have a copy. If you want it for free, it can be downloaded. If you want to give me an email address, I can send you a copy or tell you where to go and get a copy of the 4,000 changes since 1830 on the Book of Mormon. And theology has changed in it and everything. I liked it because I could take it to the door. Okay, there is a tract not done by the Tanners. 100 questions to ask your bishop. And I was looking for that last night. I have the tract. I don't know if it's in print. I've seen it or parts of it on the internet. And I like it because it pits the Book of Mormon against their Doctrines and Covenant, which is another book, and against Pearl of Great Price, which is a third book that the Mormons use. I kind of remember sometimes when I tell things, but if I've told this before, that's okay. We had some people come to our church in Hickory, and the Mormons were coming by and having Bible study with them. And so they asked somebody in the church to come and be there when the Mormons came. He said, I want to hear you side by side. And he asked me to come. So I got to come, and I'm sitting there when the Mormons showed up. They would not come in the house until the man of the house said, come on in, I want to hear you. So when they sat down, as soon as we started, I said, before we really get started, I said, I want to ask you, tell these couple about your underwear. They said, what? I said, tell them about your underwear. They said, we don't know what you're talking about. I said, yeah, you do. I said, if they become Mormons like you, faithful, they're going to wear the same underwear you've got. Tell them about your underwear. Oh, we don't know. I said, excuse me, from across the room, I see through your white shirt, the sleeve of your T-shirt, and it's marked. You never take the underwear off. When you shower with it or bathe with it, and you take off one side, it's wet, the other side is dry, you put the new one on before you take the old one off. You never, never not wearing it, right? They finally had to agree that was true. They didn't want to, but they want. Then I gave them the Book of Mormon. I said, show these people where you could become a god, and you could become a god and create your own universe. And the man of the house said, I'd never become a god. That's wrong. And they said, that doesn't teach that. I said, you're right. Book of Mormon doesn't teach that. I said, it's like bait for a fish. I said, you get them to get into the Book of Mormon. Then you bring out Doctrines and Covenants, section about 128, and that will teach you that you become a God, create your own universe. And the man house said, no, that's wrong. And the Mormons are saying, no, we don't believe that. I said, what? You don't believe that? I said, you don't believe that you can become a God? They said, no. I said, you don't believe that Lorenzo Snow saying that I said, as man is, God was. As God is, man shall become. You haven't heard that before? No, I haven't heard that. I said, really? So I took out my pen and the paper and I said, Elder so-and-so, and I started writing their names down. I said, I want you to know something. When we get done here, I'm going to call your bishop right down here at the Mormon church, and I have witnesses, and we're going to tell them that you denied your own faith. And suddenly these two guys said, oh, well, you're right. We do believe that we can become a God. And at that point, the man of the house said, I've heard enough, out of here. And he made them leave. They lied. So don't be surprised what happens. The 100 questions to ask your bishop. Puts their books against each other. Takes the Book of Mormon with the Doctrines and Covenants with Pearl of Great Price where they contradict each other. Okay, can you show me an archaeological historical proof from non-Mormon sources that would prove that the book, people and places named in the Book of Mormon actually existed? I wrote to the National Museum in Washington, D.C., and I asked them some of these questions. I got a form letter back because they've been asked evidently by a lot of people. And it says in the letter, we do have a copy of the Book of Mormon, but we have never discovered a single city mentioned in the Book of Mormon. There is no river that flows north in all of North America, which is in the Book of Mormon, once flows north, that the Indians are not related to the 12 tribes. They're actually related to Asian people. And this is all what I got back from them, that the horse and the elephant was unknown to America until we came and settled it and brought those animals with us. The wheel was unknown. There were no chariots as stated in the Book of Mormon. In other words, the Book of Mormon is totally irrelevant to the proofs that would be there. They found Jericho because they knew it had to exist. During World War II, there was a famous general who said there's a waterway that gets into Jerusalem, and they kind of found out enough from the Bible to find the waterway and come into Jerusalem, take the city, because the Bible is true. Whereas the Book of Mormon doesn't exist like that at all. Can't be done. So I wrote, and they got the form letter back. Not one city proven to exist in the Book of Mormon. There are rivers that flow north? No, none. The DNA has no links to the 12 tribes of Israel. The wheel was unknown until Western civilization brought it. Gave a long list of animals. Elephant, horse, just two. But these other animals that are mentioned in, and then there's precious stones, flowers and trees, not found in America, but in the Book of Mormon. Precious stones in the Book of Mormon, not found in America. So how could this really be a good book when it's historically unprovable, totally unprovable? Okay, if Brigham Young is a true prophet, why would one of your later prophets overturn his declaration, which stated the black man could never hold a priesthood in the LDS church until after the resurrection of all other races? Journal of Discourses, December 12th, 1854. We have copies of what he said. That's a racist religion. They finally did alter that, and now black people can actually hold some positions in the Mormon church, but there's at least one priest position black people cannot hold even today. They're definitely in the black. Why does the Book of Mormon state that Jesus was born in Jerusalem? Alma chapter 7, verse 10. That's in the Book of Mormon. When history and the Bible state he was born in Bethlehem, Matthew 2 and verse 1. And again, I like these kind of 100 questions to ask your bishop. I'm still looking for is it on the internet, but I have a copy, physical copy, and I've seen most of the questions show up on the internet. Why did Joseph Smith condone polygamy as an ordinance from God? Doctrines and Covenants, section 132, when the Book of Mormon had already condemned the practice in the Book of Jacob, 1 verse 15 and 2 verse 24. I actually got two Mormon missionaries. I had one read the passage out of Doctrines and Covenants. I had another one read the one out of Book of Jacob. And I got them to argue with each other because they contradict each other. Okay, next week we'll see what we can do more.